Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, my dearest listeners. Thank you for welcoming the FlixWise podcast into your homes and your earballs. I'm your host, writer of strongly worded letters, Lady P. No relation to Master P. And joining me today is the editor and founder of CinemaFanatic.com and the Tumblr Old Films Flicker. It's medicinal wine connoisseur, Miss Mariah E. Gates.
Hello.
And dutifully playing the role of Sir Rodrigo is the...
Thank you.
Is the maven of the cinema blog, Sales on Film. It's Miss Kristen Sales.
And a good evening to you.
I have another one if you prefer a different intro.
No, I want to play Senor Rodrigo so much. I wanted
Senor Rodrigo. Nothing else.
You get to wear a three-point hat and everything.
I know. No, that's like one of the choicest looks
and
of this movie.
And you're not exhaustified of it either.
Yeah.
These women are all here to talk about a movie made by a woman called Little Women. This is part of a series of FlixWise favorite submissions of female-directed films. Last week, we talked about Kathryn Bigelow's 1991 film Point Break. This week's film is similar in that it is also a feature film that was directed by a woman.
In the 90s.
In the 90s.
I'm sorry, that's really funny.
Yeah, but there might be one or two small differences.
So, I mean, you know, slight.
Yeah.
Slight variations.
Mariah is going to tell us why she thinks Gillian Armstrong's 1994 adaptation of Louisa May Alcott's Little Women is worthy of our little canon. Mariah, take it away.
I have seen this movie more than any other movie ever. Just on a technical level, looking at the crew, it's such an amazing film because first you have Louisa May Alcott writing about her family. It's sort of a fictionalized version of her family. Then you have, like, the screenplay is by Robin Zwicord, who is also Zoe Kazan's mom. So there's, like, layers of hot. She, like, her husband was Ilya Kazan's son.
Okay. All
yeah.
Right.
Cool. So it's a book by a woman about women, screenplay by a woman, directed by Gillian Armstrong, who is a woman. The bulk of the cast is women, and it was produced by Denise DeNovi, who is a woman. So there's lots of just female energy surrounding, like, the 200-year history of this book becoming a movie, or 150 years, whatever. And I've seen the other adaptations, and I just don't think they captured the spirit of in which the story was written, because it was a lot of dudes adapting it before, and I just don't think they got the point of the movie, and they made it all about the romances, and it's not about the romances. It's about these women becoming, going from little girls to women, and that's really what it's about, and I feel like this film captures that really beautifully.
Yeah.
It also stars super hot Winona Ryder at the peak of her stardom, and she has really long hair at one point and then, like, really short hair, and it's like everything you ever wanted in one film.
Okay, can you give us a little rundown of the stuff that happens in it?
So it starts when the girls are between ages, like, 10 and 15, I think, something like that. And they're growing up during Civil War. Their father has gone off to fight the war. They're living with their mother and their live-in maid, like, cook lady. And they used to be a prominent family in Massachusetts, in Concord, but they have sort of lost their money due to being good people, essentially, is what you kind of get from it. So they're not living in poverty, so to speak, but they are not rich, upper echelon people anymore, even though that's all their friends are. And it covers several Christmases, and it starts on Christmas, and they've gathered. They don't have presents, but, you know, they're all together, and they're sisters. And then it sort of goes from them meeting their neighbor, who is this boy who was born in this rich family, but to artists and a rebellious daughter, and a rebellious son, I guess, and an artist daughter. And so he's kind of a misfit, mixing with their misfitness. And then the women grow up and they have to start getting married, and the war ends, and you have to either get married or have a job. But it's like, can you have a job if you're a woman? And so there's all that mixed in. And then eventually everyone either is dead or married.
Yes.
Oh. Yes.
But why? So you've seen this movie a lot.
I've seen it a lot. I saw it in theaters when it was new, mm-hmm. and I loved it so much. And I remember when it was over, I, like, talked to my mom about it for, like, 2 hours because she'd seen the other adaptations and read the book, and she, like, had a lot to say. Mm-hmm. And I loved it so much. And then I had the cassette tape, and I watched it so much that it broke.
Wow.
Like, it broke.
Okay.
But it broke. Yeah. It literally broke. And then I got the DVD, and so now that DVD is never in its spot on my DVD shelf because it's always next to my TV. Because mm-hmm. I watch
Keep
it all the time.
Putting it on.
Yeah.
All right, Kristen, how do you feel about Little Women?
Well, Little Women has a very, I think, unique place in my movie-watching history. Because unlike Mariah, I didn't really come from a family where we watched a lot of movies. Like, sort of in my family, we had maybe 5 or 10 rotating VHS tapes that we would just sort of watch. I mean, that were like non-Disney animated movies. And we would just sort of watch it throughout the history of our childhoods. And I have 2 younger siblings. So, like, every time they sort of, like, came of a certain age, these movies would come up again. And we'd all sort of watch them together. And so Little Women was just one of these movies that we had around, and we would just sort of like watch periodically. And I think I sort of grouped it in with sort of this series of childhood movie fantasy period dramas that were sort of about women, and I'm including you know, Secret Garden.
Mm-hmm. Also directed by a woman.
Also directed by a woman, yes, of course. You know, Black Beauty.
Directed by a woman.
Yes, I know. See, there was this whole thing in this sort of like mid-90s period where there were like these sort of, I guess, literary adaptations that were sort of for girls and about girls. And Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken is another one.
I don't
one
think I've seen that one.
Oh, that's another podcast for another time. Okay. But it would just sort of be in there. And I remember it was sort of like a comfort food movie. Like, I would watch it if I was homesick. And I actually I had a gallbladder surgery 4 years ago or something. And I just had to be at home for, you know, 2 weeks, and I couldn't do anything. And it was just one of the movies that I just put on to watch because I had watched it so many times, and it just made me feel so good. And that makes it sort of unique because it's one of those movies that I just associate with my own childhood nostalgia and with my own sort of family so much that I don't think of it as a film that I would analyze critically. Like, I haven't really taken the time to take it seriously as someone who's interested in cinema. Mm-hmm. So it has, like, a unique place in my heart. And sometimes I think, you know, I don't want to analyze this critically. I just want to put this on and have it make me feel good. Mm-hmm. And then when I met Mariah and found out that, like, her history of it and that she uses it sort of, like, medicinally sometimes.
It's my medicinal wine.
Yeah, just to feel better. It's like, oh, I guess this is probably a widespread, or at least there are probably people out here that, you know, have this sort of, like, familial association with this movie, and they use it that way. And I think that's fine, and I think it's really interesting. And it's like, you know, thinking back on it now that I'm someone who does look at movies critically, to look at all of these really talented young actors who are in this movie, and the quality of the screenplay, the quality of the direction, the, you know, amount of money put in, the sort of, it was like a Touchstone movie, like back when Touchstone was doing like really awesome things in the mid-90s, and Disney was just like, here, have a lot of money to make these really good movies. It's
what is another Touchstone?
Well, I think in the same year, I'm thinking about, like, Ed Wood.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Like, also another Denise DeNovi produced thing. Like, she
was on fire in the
right,
90s.
Like, they gave her, a lot of money. I think she was, like, one of the bigwigs in Touchstone, if not the person in charge. And it was basically just, they hired, like, a lot of female screenwriters, first of all, and just made, like, a lot of really interesting, well-appointed, movies like that were for adults but could also appeal to children. Like they weren't really like they were Disney movies, but they weren't. So they were sort of wholesome a little bit, but then they were also like for adults, mm-hmm. and they weren't pandering. So it had like that cross section where you could like watch it with your family and like have a nice time. Like and they were all good stories, and I think that's Little Women is like a prime example of that.
It's
but like
barely rated PG.
Yeah, because it's just so there's nothing really objectionable in it, but it's also not like.
What about where Meg wears the lipstick?
And has her boobs showing a little bit.
It's scandalous.
That's probably why it's PG for that scene right there.
I know, but it's not like, it's not treated in a, like a very like sexual manner or whatever.
No, I know. I think that's why it's such a solid film. It feels like the kind of films that were made that not to be like, it was better in the old days, but it feels like the kind of films that they used to make a lot in the like 30s, 40s, or not 30s, but like 40s, 50s. Where they were just solid literary adaptations mm-hmm. That maybe had a little bit of modern politics mixed in, but not very much. Mm-hmm. And this one is very, like, it's coming at the wave of Riot Girl sort of girl power kind of stuff. And that's,
yeah, it's like
and
that's, super.
And that's in there. And it's in the original text, too, but it's, like, the kind of feminism that's in her text is sort of very 1850s. Feminism,
right.
Independent woman in a society where that was not really a thing. And then they like heighten it with like 90s feminism, and it's just
it is like film. I would say that it is a 90s movie, but it's not dated.
Right. No, right. No, they do it really well that mm-hmm. it like holds.
Yeah.
It holds up.
We should say we're all roughly the same age, and this movie came out during our formative years.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was 8.
Yeah.
Well, then I was 7.
7. Yeah. Yeah. This is one of the very first movies that I saw in the theater. Mm. And I remember coming home and sobbing because I think it was probably one of the first movie encounters that I had with death.
Oh, yeah. Should we spoil who dies? Should we reenact that scene from Friends?
I don't know.
Yeah, put it in the freezer.
if you're not crying at that point, you're probably dead inside. Yeah. And so you're not dead inside.
I'm not. No,
it was very dramatic. Yeah, and that became sort of this is another thing that happened in my family because we watched it so much that, well, spoiler alert, when Beth dies or whatever, it became an in-joke, a sales family in-joke, and we used to play a lot of Oregon Trail. So we would always name one of the people in our wagon trains Beth.
Beth, there you go.
To see if she died. and to see if she died. Like, we would all, because, you know, everyone, at least one person in your wagon train always dies. So if Beth died, we saw it sort of as an accomplishment. Like, oh.
We didn't actually mention.
Of course it was Beth. Of course it was Beth.
We didn't actually mention the cast, which is also why this film works so well. Yeah. It's like, you have this very strong lead with Winona Ryder as the sort of tomboy Joe.
Peak Winona.
Yeah.
Coming off like a string of solid 90s
string. She had her Oscar nomination the year before for Age of Innocence, and then she got a Best Actress nomination for this one.
Yeah.
And she should have won. She lost to Jessica Lange. I don't know. I haven't seen the Jessica Lange movie, but.
It's okay. Wino forever.
So then it has Trini Alvarado, who was like, Alvarado, I always say her name wrong. She was a child actress, and this was one of her first like leads as an adult. You had Kirsten Dunst, same year that she did Interview with a Vampire.
Right,
she gave it those dual performances that year. It was like, that's why she's still making movies.
Yeah,
you
sassy.
Had Grown Up Amy.
Oh, I don't remember.
Samantha Mathis.
Samantha Mathis. She was like huge in the like indie 90s films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you had Claire Danes.
Claire Danes.
In like original Cry Face. And it was
life.
The same year.
Yeah.
As My So-Called Life.
Right.
And then you had baby Christian Bale.
Yeah.
With his little teeth that are pointed.
Yeah.
He's like vampire teeth. And then you had like Gabriel Byrne coming off of all those like late 80s, early 90s like serious period pieces he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have Susan Sarandon.
Susan
topping
Sarandon.
It all off, you know,
Sarandon.
As Marmee. And then you also have like Mary Wicks. So you're like, she made her first film in Now Voyager. And then here she is like. Playing the old dowager.
She in Now Voyager?
She's the nurse that like.
Oh my god, that's
the tough
her?
Nurse. That's Mary Wicks.
Awesome.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Right, it's great. And then you have Eric Stoltz.
Eric Stoltz is like being
same
sort
year
of
as Pulp Fiction.
Being sort of romantic for a change.
Yeah, He's also in The House of Mirth.
Yeah.
Super hot.
Couple years later, yeah.
I feel like there's somebody else in this movie who's great. Oh, you know who's in it and is like not popular again for another like 20 years is Donald Logue.
Oh yeah,
yeah. He's in it for a second.
Yeah.
Like that's right.
I know there's just a lot of like really, really good, really good people.
Mm-hmm. Great cast.
But I do want to make sure that this isn't purely nostalgia talking here. And I don't think it is because I've gone back and rewatched it and I think it's a really good movie. It's really well made. And as you say, I think it emphasizes the right parts of the story, the most interesting parts of the story. And it's gorgeous. And it's one of those period pieces where things feel tactile. You get a sense of how things would look and the way things would smell. And and
it's very warm.
Yeah.
Part where she's covered in flour.
It is. And it's very, like sensual but non-sexual. Like there's like a very pointed emphasis on like the home and like all of the objects in the home, which I think is like a very female point of view in terms of like, these are the sort of things that a lot of times women directors are interested in, which is, you know, these like sort of these like domestic spaces and how the people that inhabited them, like how they relate to each other and how they relate to the spaces. And it is, it's a, I think being set at Christmas, it does have that sort of like thing where it's snowy, but it's warm inside and it just makes you feel good, but it's so beautifully shot and the performances are so like there's so much affection between the actors it's like very palpable it makes you feel like you can tell that the people performing the scenes are feeling these things and these spaces and that's conveyed to you as a viewer
right Gillian Armstrong made My Brilliant Career. Which is so that's sort of similar
Judy Davis.
Yeah. Indeed. But I don't know if I should spoil My Brilliant Career, but the endings are different.
So that I find is fascinating. So we should spoil it.
Spoil. Okay.
She doesn't choose the guy. She chooses her career.
Yeah.
And the thing about Little Women, I looked this up recently cuz I actually did not read the book until January of this year. So I'd seen this movie like a million times. And for 20 years, and then I finally read the book. And it's actually two books in one book. And she only wrote it because she wrote, like Joe writes, these, like, violent sort of grisly books. And then her publisher was like, you need to write something sort of for the girls. That's where the money is. Mm-hmm. And she's like, I don't want to do that. And then they were like, we'll publish your dad's book if you'll write this for us. And so in order for her dad to get a book published, she wrote this begrudgingly, you know, kids thing, which if you read it, it's really, she's not like, it doesn't feel like it was a forced novel, but it's definitely very like what was popular at the time, the sort of moralization. So each section is sort of a moralized story. But as she's writing it, it was sort of serialized and she had written this Laurie character because that's what they wanted, the like boy next door and all that. But she didn't want him she didn't want the marriage to happen because she herself didn't ever want to get married. She didn't see the point. She was self-sufficient. And at the time, the only reason to get married was to have someone support you, and she didn't need that, you know, and she probably didn't want kids. So, but the publisher was like, everyone has to get married. So that's why she brought in the Gabriel Byrne character, the Professor Bear character, to like sort of fulfill what the publisher wanted but also piss everyone off. And when you read the book, he's not that great. And my mom was always telling me that in the previous versions and in the book, it always creeped her out and she just couldn't understand it. And then when she saw this version and it's Gabriel Byrne and he's hot and charming, she was finally like, I buy it this time.
Yeah.
Now, I know the biggest fight I ever have with people is why didn't she marry Laurie? And I was never on the Laurie team. So I'm always like, I don't know why you're upset. Kristen can explain why people are upset because she has that.
Well, when I was a kid, it's like, my God, it seems perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the beginning of the movie is so strong because you want Laurie and Joe to be together because it's like every girl's dream. The boy next door is like your best friend. He's super cute. He likes you, even though you're like smart and a nerd and you're like, this is awesome. Mm-hmm. And he's like into you being independent or whatever, and you guys can just like hang out and get married and like be together forever. It's awesome. But then it's, and that part is so strong when you watch it and you're little, that beginning, and you're just like, okay, whatever. And then, you know, as time goes by or whatever, Lori grows up and he's like a bit of a douche.
Mm-hmm.
He grows that horrible, whatever, that soul patch
thing, yeah.
Whatever the heck it is. He's like hitting on Amy. You're like, dude, what the, why did you get so gross? But it's like in your mind, when you're a kid, you're like, okay, no, but he's still like that kid, and I can, like, if he gets with Joe, like, it'll be okay because they can, like, go back to the way that they were before. So it's just like this, you know, juvenile thing where you're like, your associations are so strong. And I think also the thing compacted is like, okay, I'm willing to, like, sort of let go of Lori or whatever, let him be gross, but if Joe's publishing her stuff and she's living in her, like, awesome apartment or whatever, why does she need to get married? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the thing that also, as a kid, I was like, who's this old guy? Like, what? Why does it, why does it need to happen?
I think, you know? Like, from a story point of view and in the novel, it really doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You can tell this is what the publisher wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the only reason it works in this movie is because Gabriel Byrne is so hot and so much younger than the character is supposed to be. He looks maybe 40.
Yeah.
Instead of like 55.
No, I mean the older, know? I mean the older I get, the more I understand how that would be appealing for Joe. But it's like, you know, I think it is just that sort of like young girl fantasy that like Christian Bale is like,
he's so cute.
I also,
he's so dreamy.
See, I never found him attractive.
What?
I always thought Gabriel Byrne was more attractive.
That's so bonkers. But it's fine. Like, I mean, because Gabriel Byrne is attractive, but it's like,
he's so hot.
But it's like, it's also, I mean, it's that thing I'm talking about.
Christian
it's
Bale like, is a baby.
Right, he's so cute.
Yeah, he's adorable.
He's a baby. But I think that's why the character is so strong, is that she recognizes the difference between, like, real love and that, like, juvenile childhood.
But is it real love? It's sort of thing. Paternalistic.
I don't think it is, because she doesn't ever let him tell her, dictate her life. It would be paternalistic if he said, do this, and she did it.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't do it right away. She says, this is what I write, this is what I do. And the only reason she ends up sort of taking his advice is because she has all these emotions that she needs to get out, and that's how she expresses it. I don't think it's because he told her to do that.
Really? It doesn't remind you of like the student teacher vibe?
I don't think so.
No.
I feel like she's such a strong character and such a strong person that she never lets anybody tell her how to live her life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even when he's coming to maybe ask her to marry her, like, he chickens out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's her that's like, no, I want this.
Yeah. Like, but in their first encounter, when he's serving her the strong coffee, she's clearly flustered. And that's fine. She's enamored.
Because it's Gabriel Byrne.
He's very attractive. Certainly, yes.
He's super
hot. He's still an older man. It's an older man kind of vibe, which, I don't know, there's something still to this day that makes it, still just makes Lori all the more appealing.
I think the reason I don't get it is I always liked older men.
Okay.
Since I was like 8, clearly because of this movie, I always liked people who were 35 to 40,
mm-hmm.
which I'm getting closer to 35 to 40, so now it's okay and not creepy. But like, I was always attracted to people in their 30s
mm-hmm.
from like childhood.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't get liking people that are the same age as you. Okay. I don't know. I don't get it.
Fair enough. Does the second half of the movie sort of dampen our appreciation of the first half when Lori does turn into?
I mean, I think it's just painful because
it hurts.
It's painful, but that's the point of the movie. It's you know, from
mm-hmm.
little girls to little women, and I think that that second half is just not as fun because it doesn't have the warmth of the family bonding, and that's what people identify with.
It's not as fun because it really is like going from the protective womb of like childhood to like she's thrust into like super muddy, the streets aren't paved in New York,
mm-hmm.
and her skirt is always muddy. Although her skirt was always muddy when she was,
it was like fun muddy,
but it was like fun trampling in the woods muddy. And now it's like, who knows what that mud is muddy, you know? And she's getting rejected because
it's tough. Yeah, it's that hard reality,
right?
And then you know, you have that coupled with, like, Amy becoming sort of a gold digger.
Yeah. Almost. Ugh, I hate
but
Amy.
She was always, Amy's terrible in the book, too. Amy's okay. just the worst.
Okay.
But the thing that I think is interesting about those are the two characters that are the most focused on in this film. And because in the book, there's a little more balance between all four, but really, it's those two. And I think it's Jo is so self-aware and so determined to be her own person. And Amy is so sort of stuck in how women are supposed to be and how they're supposed to get married and they're supposed to be rich. And she wants to go back to that, even though she never had that. Like, they make it more clear in the book that the two older girls remember when they had a lush life. And Amy only has stories. And she wants that so bad that she clouds, and she's always trying to change who she is. And it's not until Lori comes back and makes her remember who she really is. That's why the match almost works, because he makes her finally be herself and not this version of herself that she thinks she should be. Whereas Jo is always herself.
Mm. I don't know that I think that the match between Lori and Amy is supposed to work exactly. I think it's
creepy.
A compromise on both of their parts in some ways. I mean, I guess not in Lori is getting not Jo, but close enough to Jo.
Yeah.
And Amy's getting a stable
even
home.
More money than
Yeah. She's getting a lot of money, which is what she wants, but
yeah,
she's marrying
someone
who's like...
Yeah, it's like when sort of terrible people compromise and decide to be sort of terrible together.
Yeah.
It's kind of romance.
It's similar to what happens in most Jane Austen novels, where the one daughter, the youngest usually, goes off and off the rails and ends up with a horrible dude. And it's
right.
Like Jane Austen was such a moralist that, like, they don't get a happy ending. And I think Louisa May Alcott is more like, those extremes aren't realistic. And so she gave Amy sort of what we know is going to be probably not the greatest marriage, but it's not a punishment either, because so many people get stuck in that anyways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Could be worse than Larry.
Yeah.
And I do kind of want to talk about this, because when I think of this movie, I think of it as being extremely heartfelt and sincere and borderline. I'm sure Hallmark could do an adaptation of this story. And
if Hallmark did it, it would be way more.
It would be way more emphasis on the love story.
It'd be more like
right.
it is in the book, I think,
right.
Where it's very...
Yeah, but
you
I think this
a
movie,
lot of lessons.
Yeah,
yeah,
it toes the line really well between it never verges on overly sentimental.
Yeah,
I think it never really it doesn't. It's very sweet, but it's not treacly,
mm-hmm.
And I think it cuts a lot of the sweetness with a lot of sadness, and as we say, the second half of the movie is very sad, and we see our characters compromise, and I think that ultimately that's what makes this story endure, is that, yeah, we see, it feels really realistic.
Yeah, I think one of the strengths of the movie is they never lose sight of the fact that it's wartime, so even though, like, the March House is sort of like this cloistered, like, very warm, safe space, it's like outside there's a lot of turmoil, and that occasionally, like, punctures the, you know, world that they have. And, you know, there's sickness, there's poverty, there's all these issues, and it never gets, like you're saying, overly schmaltzy, but it's like, this is a real world, and these people are, like, actually dealing with things that they have to deal with and that have consequences. Mm-hmm. So even though there is this sort of, like, you know, this pervading idea of how I think about Little Women is, you know, the women putting on the girls putting on the plays and having a good time and sort of, like, hugging Marmee. It's like there's a lot of stuff going on that is real and mature, and they have to deal with it. And I think that's what makes the movie successful, is, like, so many good sort of children's movies sort of from this time period. It's like these are real issues, and they're dealing with them in an authentic way.
Mm-hmm. We touched a little bit on this, but this is an early 90s movie. coming off the heels of the Riot Girl movement. There's
such feminism.
So much feminism.
So one of my favorite scenes in it is the medicinal wine scene where she's sitting around with these dudes discussing politics and whether women should vote, whether anyone, you know, they basically say like black people should vote, and it's like the one Donald Logue brings up black men can vote, and then the men are talking about why they think or don't think women should vote, and they're all saying like women are better than men, they should get to vote, and Joe is just like, you guys are a bunch of idiots. Mm-hmm. Women are not better than men. Men don't vote because they're better. They vote because they're men, and women should vote because they're equals,
human beings.
And we're human. And it's like, that moment was such a strong moment for me because it was like, I had never realized, like, my parents did a really good job of like shielding me from inequalities in the world, and I would experience them by seeing it in movies. And then I would have to ask my mom, like, what is happening? So when she's saying that women are equal to men, I had never thought that women weren't equal to men. And then I had to ask my mom, like, what women didn't used to vote? And she had to explain me this whole process about how at that point it hadn't even been 100 years since women could vote. And I'm like, what? Yes. Yeah. And then, you know, it was just, like, really such an important moment because she's so aware of – and then it's coupled with this sad line at the end where he says, you should have been a lawyer, and she said, I should have been a great many things. And it's like, that's Louise May Alcott saying – I wish I could have been all of these things, and the only reason I couldn't, because she came from a good family, the only reason she couldn't was she was a woman. And you get that again when Lori's going to college. She can't go because what? Oh, she's a woman. You know who would have had a better time at college and spent less money on billiards? Joe. You know who would have read everything in the Harvard Library? Joe.
It's true.
But
it's true. You know. I revisited this movie. The first time I saw it, it was kind of traumatic. And then when I revisited this movie as a teenager, I think, and that was when I was first discovering the music of the time, it had a really profound impact. It was Winona Ryder, all of Winona Ryder's movies essentially formed who I am.
Because she just has a very authentic strength of character.
Yeah.
In all of them, and especially... Joe is just so self-assured.
She's such a great
that
character.
It's like, whoa. Like, I think it is that thing, if you catch this movie, if you're a girl and you catch this movie at a certain age, and it's that age that you're talking about where you don't realize that you can't, that there are things that you can't do or the things that people don't want you to do because you're a girl, everything in this movie makes sense. Because it's like, Joe is like, oh, of course she's going to do whatever you want. If you watch it a little bit later, it's like you understand... sort of, because you probably have experienced these sort of gendered politics, but it's like, this is a great movie to watch when you're 7 or 8, because when you're 7 or 8, you don't know, like, Jo seems just like you, because she's doing everything, she's strong-headed, she's doing whatever you want, which is what you do when you're 7 or 8.
Yeah.
Nobody's really telling you, like, oh, don't play sports, Don't write stories. Yeah.
Don't write stories about mischief and mayhem and poison.
Right.
Because that's not girly.
Right. And I remember I was writing stories
when I was eight. I was reading Poe.
Yeah.
That's what I was doing.
Me too.
Because Poe is great.
Yeah. I was super into Poe. Anyway.
Poe for children.
sidebar. But it's like, I think that is such a strong, important thing, because you're like, there's nothing really to rebel against when you don't have an understanding that people are trying to oppress you,
right?
And that's how Jo lives her life, which is like very inspirational.
This is
why she's gonna be a homeless, decrepit spinster.
That too.
Yeah.
With little Tuppy the dog.
The worst ways to, you know. When you were younger, did you always see yourself as Joe? This is one of those novel. Okay,
yes.
Always Joe.
Yeah. No.
Okay,
because I was a super, super tomboy. So there were the other sisters to me were some of them. Well, Amy certainly came across as frivolous.
Yeah.
I just thought that her being as girly as she was and caring about girly things, I was like, that's silly. So I was always just like Team Joe all the way. And now that I'm older, I realize the variations in their characters and the there are different ways to be a woman, and that's fine. But, like, when I was young, I was always just like, no, I want to be, like, Señora Rodrigo.
I liked Jo because she was so opinionated, and she was never afraid to say what she thought. Like, she calls him crummy old Mr. Brooke or pokey old Mr. Brooke. Like, she calls it as she sees it, and she always does. And that's how I always was. I would tell people.
And she's not, like, punished for it.
No,
like, even she's though her just, mom is, like, people try to be nicer. Like, it wasn't, it was, like, her personality was always being supported by her family. And then you have Beth being sort of softer and bringing out the softness in Jo. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, a nice balance when you see that in the movie. It's like, oh, like, maybe, like, if you're a, you know, bossy young girl or a tomboy or something, it's like, maybe I don't need to be so tough all the time because, like, Beth sort of has good points. So the way that the personalities of the sisters, of the daughters are balanced, like, sort of helps to inform, like, depending on which character you identify more, it helps to, like, bring out those aspects of the other March girls.
Is this one of the first examples of the sort of the foursome of women, and they're all supposed to represent a different personality type? I can't think
I think Austin did that a lot, too.
Okay.
She always had
it's pretty popular.
She usually did, like, the two sisters and then, like, sisters of the men in it. So there's always at least four women in all of Austin's.
Mm. But, I mean, but were they in this specific way that we still use today, obviously?
You mean in movies?
In movies and television, especially. I mean, I'm thinking
kind of like the Sex and the City
sort of thing. Sex and the City sort of thing, yeah.
I don't think it's new. I just think that every time it's presented, it comes across as novel because there maybe aren't as many examples. So it's like, obviously, a set of sisters is a good narrative
There's actually a great series of films in the late 30s into the early 40s that are the four daughters, four daughters, four wives, four mothers, and it's four sisters.
Okay.
Sort of, it's very similar in the idea of each sister being a different kind of girl or whatever, except they all obviously, hence the titles, get married. And I think it's a thing that when you have women, a group of women, they need to be each a different kind of woman. That's just sort of how storytelling has told us women are.
I guess so.
Which, but, you know.
I think, and
but then you have, like, the Four Musketeers sort of thing, and then like Seven Samurai and things like that. And, like, it happens in male storytelling too. I think
it's
like
just a group usually not thing. They're just usually not related.
Yeah.
Because men have more spaces for them to be in a single sex group, like the military or things like that. So that's where you get your variable ideas about masculinity, whereas there aren't as many cultural spaces for a group of women to come together. So it's usually when...
Except sewing circles.
Right. I mean, okay. Well...
Looking Gone with the Wind.
I'm still waiting for that sewing circle big budget trilogy to hit theaters, but it's...
those crazy quilters, let me tell
you. Yeah, I mean, so a lot of times it's mostly familial. So it would be sisters or sisters-in-law or some...
Yeah.
So, and then also because it's like you keep it in the home.
Right.
You know, so
right.
That's...
And I think maybe that's why we're getting, in the last 20 years, we've seen more examples of this as women have left the domestic sphere and becomes more, I don't know how the women in Sex and the City
like
met,
women,
but,
women friend groups.
Right, exactly.
Right, because
it's
like you're more, I mean, women are more like in the public space.
Right, right.
And it's not... like second wave feminism where there was still a lot of, it was like very doggy dog and very competitive, like that Mad Men thing, you know, where Peggy and Joan sort of could have been friends, but there's just too much competition. So now once you get into the 90s, it's like, hey, let's maybe not like kill each other. Let's be friends.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's definitely been a more push towards sororal friendships rather than girl fights.
Yeah.
Like I feel like girl fights were created by dudes. Girls fight, that is true, but it's like the kind of sensationalized women against each other, I think, is just such a male fantasy and has been so heightened by male storytelling that it's like it's become a cultural idea that if women are together, they're fighting. Mm-hmm. And it's not true.
Yeah.
It's not exclusively true.
It's not exclusively true. Yeah. But it's like that's so much of the stories about women is women versus women and the Madonna whore sort of thing. And it's just like there's so much more to it than that. And we and we're just now as we get more and more women telling women's stories, we're seeing more and more positive reinforcements of the fact that women can have women friends.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Thumbs up.
Before sign off, I feel like we have not done the requisite amount of gushing about Susan Sarandon that is required.
Are we just
going to
be
like
really
this?
Gay for Susan Sarandon right now? I'm prepared.
She's like, I love her.
She's like the ultimate mom.
She's so yes.
In this movie, she's like the mom everyone like, wants and hopes to have.
She does their hair and doesn't yell at them while doing it.
Yeah, which then you can tell it's a fiction film.
Yeah.
It's never happened in the history of a woman doing her daughter's hair.
No.
It's such a true-to-life little moment. Because you know anyone who's ever had their mom comb their hair, like, looks at that moment and they're like, yes, this is what I want. I don't want tears before bedtime. Yeah. I want my mom to just
those are the kind of little moments that women bring to storytelling that and men don't know about.
That's right, because it's not their experience and they don't know how to render that.
Yeah.
And that's not something that would be, like, typically scripted.
And then she's so sassy in this movie. She's like, women can run and it's just because they're in corsets. Why are you even saying the women are strange because they're running? And then he blushes and you're like,
yep.
Let's talk about corsets some more, Marmee. Let's do it. I get the idea that, like, she does that whenever she talks to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and like, it makes total sense that these are her daughters.
Yeah.
You know, like, it comes from the top.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's – you get a sense of how she has implemented her ethos and her worldview onto her daughters and – or she's – They have adapted much of her worldview, but you also see, you know, she's older, she's wiser, and the melancholy registers so much. And I love that line where she says, you know, I wish I could have given – I wish it was a more just world for my girls. And that was like – when I watched it this time, that was what got
me. It's a beautiful moment because – it's when both girls have realized that slut-shaming is a thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening because she was slut-shamed. And it's like – wow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's the girls dress her up and then she's shamed for dressing, for playing this part that she thinks is how women should be. And it's like, she is how women should be and women are always shamed for it. And this is the moment that they realize that. And this is the moment that Marmee has to explain life's going to suck outside of Orchard House. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's horrible because I think lots of mothers end up having to have that conversation, not just with their daughters, with their sons too, but like a specific set of limitations that women face that their mothers have to tell them, by the way, this is the struggle that you're going to go through. And maybe by the time you have kids, it'll be better. But I wasn't, you know, we haven't fixed it yet.
Yeah.
Like one of the main conversations I have with my mom is I'll tell her about some horrible thing that happened and she's like, I thought we fixed this in the 70s, and I'm like, no. You didn't.
Yeah.
These are conversations that have always happened and will always happen.
Because
it's, you know, there's only so much. It's like these are the specific things your mom has to tell you. Like, it's, you know, like they try to make, like Marmee tries to make such a like a comforting, idealized home life for them and not shelter them from the world, but sort of drive their life experiences towards a certain understanding and sort of, you know, give the March girls compassion, like for their neighbors and, you know, to teach them to be charitable and stuff. But then it's like, I can teach you to be a certain way as much as I can, but I can't control the world you're going to encounter after you leave the home. And that's like, that's what makes Little Women so melancholy and the second half of the movie so like deeply unsatisfying, because it's like, yeah, you can do your best, but that's not,
yeah,
this isn't reality. Yeah.
Being a grown-up is about compromising.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And being a grown-up woman is certainly about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In that same speech that Marmee's giving, I believe she also says the line, time erodes all such beauty. She's talking about how pretty
beauty fades, but what it cannot diminish is the wonderful workings of your mind. Yeah. That's a beautiful sentiment. But regarding the beauty fading bit, I mean, tell that to Susan Sarandon, am I right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude.
You're goddamn right. Babe. Beauty fades unless your name is Susan Sarandon. Yes.
In which case, they have to put age makeup.
You're hot forever.
They have to put age makeup on you to make you look the age you are.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, yeah. Man. All right. On that, now that I brought the discourse down,
I have to say one more time that I love Gabriel Byrne in this movie. I just like, he
if
is
you're listening,
my,
Gabriel.
He is my ideal man.
He's
and
also
if,
not aged
you know,
at all.
Like, I feel like the whole reason that I'm pushing 30 and have very rarely dated anyone is because I've never met Gabriel Byrne or someone who looks like him.
Mm-hmm. If you're listening, Gabriel.
And Gabriel Byrne lookalikes.
We have it.
You know, but actually really Gabriel Byrne.
Yeah.
Because.
Okay, hook it up. Hook it up, Gabriel Byrne.
You can do it.
All right, on that note, let's put this to a vote. Kristen, what say you? Is Little Women worthy of the FlixWise favorites list?
Sure.
Sure. Why not?
Why not? It's a great movie.
Yeah. Mariah?
I would say hell yeah.
Hell yeah. All right, I'm with you there. I'm going to go with hell yeah as well. And that's the way we frame it. FlixWise, that is. Listeners, care to gather around the virtual hearth and regale us with tales of your first encounter with the March Clan? Well, you can do so on our website, flixwise.com. And to encourage the further exchanging of ideas, we can also be called on at this address, www.facebook.com/flixwise. Or you can write me directly on Twitter. The handle is @flixwise. And those who wish to bestow their greatest generosities upon us can rate us and leave us a comment on iTunes. Seriously, you should really go and do that. That would be super awesome. On our next show, we're briefly back on Sight and Sound duty. I'm very excited to announce that Ed Neumeier, the screenwriter of RoboCop and Starship Troopers, is going to join me for a discussion on Fritz Lang's 1927 sci-fi classic, Metropolis. And then after that, we'll have a few more entries in the female filmmaker extravaganza. But until then, Mariah, thank you so much for submitting Little Women to the FlixWise favorites list.
Thanks for letting me talk about it on ad nauseum because it's my favorite. I'll probably go watch it when I get home tonight.
Riled up.
It's already in my DVD player, actually. Just waiting for me.
Kristen, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Until next time, let's raise a glass and toast to a more just world.